Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Today's episode has been sponsored by Jay McLaughlin. Jay McLaughlin is a timeless lifestyle brand with incredible style and a spirit of connection. I am obsessed with Jay McLaughlin and have been so honored that they are sponsoring my Zibbyverse tour. It just so happens that the tour goes to so many communities and areas of the country that have Jay McLaughlin stores. And I love that the brand is philanthropic through Jay McLaughlin's local and loyal programming. Host store events to give back to organizations that are meaningful to Jay McLaughlin's local communities. I also love the fact that the clothes are just so chic. They make me feel polished and modern. And the best part is that most of the line comes in fabrics that don't wrinkle. I especially love the dresses, the cashmere sweaters, the other sweaters. You'll see them all over my Instagram. I typically tag at Jay McLaughlin. And so you can check it out. It is absolutely one of my favorite brands, and I am over the moon excited to be working with them. In fact, I want to share the love with all of you. Jay McLaughlin is giving 20% off new customers and listeners of my podcast with special code ZIBBY20. Capital ZIBBY 20. That's 20% off for new customers and listeners of the podcast with special code capital Z Zibby 20. Take advantage of it today. My favorites are this white open long cashmere sweater that I've been wearing on every flight that I've taken on this tour. I have a blue with light blue horizontal striped sweater, several dresses I even wore on Good Morning America. Check it out, Jay McLaughlin. Thanks so much. Welcome to Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books with Zibby. I'm the host, Zibby Owens. I am an author. My latest is blank, pub date March 1st, a novel. I'm also a podcaster, obviously, a publisher, a bookstore owner, and so much more. If you love books, you're in the right place. In fact, we call it the Zibbyverse, or really, the LA Times called it the Zibbyverse, and we're going with it. Go to ZibbyOwens.com to learn more and follow me on Instagram at Zibby Owens. Jenny Hollander is the author of Everyone Who Can Forgive Me Is Dead, a novel. Jenny is the director of content strategy at Marie Claire, where she oversees the brand's daily coverage, as well as the hashtag ReadWithMC book club. Before moving to Marie Claire, she worked at Bustle. A graduate of the Columbia University School of Journalism, Jenny spent 10 years in New York before moving back to her hometown of London. Everyone Who Can Forgive Me Is Dead is her first novel. Welcome, Jenny. Thank you so much for coming on Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books to discuss Everyone Who Can Forgive Me Is Dead.
Thank you so much for having me, Zibby. I'm so excited to be here.
Yay. Okay, Jenny, tell everybody what your book is about, please.
So this is a fast-paced and twisty thriller about a woman who thought she outran her past. She witnessed a horrific massacre at her journalism school 9 years earlier. And then when she finds out that a classmate is trying to make a movie about that night, the truth about what really happened will really jeopardize everything that the main character thought she knew about her life and about herself.
Wow. And where did this come from?
I like to joke that it's almost as though my life took a very different turn. It's about a Brit that moves to New York. I am a Brit who moved to New York when I was 22, the same age as my protagonist Charlie did. And I went to journalism school. And then from there, I established a career in New York as a journalist. And for me, I was very lucky. Nothing went horribly wrong. And for Charlie, I just started thinking about what might have happened if my life had taken a very different turn when I was very isolated from my friends and from my family and in a new place, in a very new media environment. And that's a big part of the book, you know, how the media really focuses on Charlie and how, you know, the media really tends to treat survivors of tragedies like pieces of meat in some ways and really takes advantage of them in a very vulnerable state. And I started just thinking about, I don't know, all these dark things. And then I sort of twisted that into a almost alternate history of my last 10 years and what I would have been like if my life had gone, as I said, in a very different direction. Because this book is a thriller at its heart, but it's also about trauma. It's about finding yourself. It's about, in some ways, coming to terms and treating things that have happened to you that you never really recovered from. And there's a lot of me in it, but I also, my father-in-law refers to it as Arc Jenny, which I think is really funny. But I also can assure you that nothing like that has ever, ever happened to me. But it is definitely, I'm writing a second book now. The first one is definitely more personal than the second one is.
Interesting. Well, maybe you wouldn't tell me though, or tell anybody if you had any secrets, right? Because they wouldn't be secrets anymore.
It would just be the ultimate, you know. Yes. If I wrote a book called Everyone Who Can Forgive Me Is Dead and then said, oh yeah, nothing like that ever happened to me.
Right. And then it turns out it was true.
Yeah. Right.
That could be the next book is when the author of this book, her secrets come out, we could just keep going in circles on this whole thing. You wrote in a really interesting way about New York, you know, from another perspective, and you called it a survivor city. Tell me about some of these differences in the heart of New York and how do you really feel about it?
Oh my God, I love New York. And Charlie's journey with New York is very much like my journey with New York. And I got there and everyone around me was constantly saying, oh my God, this place is amazing. Where all the dreams come true. This is so beautiful and incredible. And I just looked around and I was like, really? And I mean, New York in so many ways, the quality of life in so many ways is low, right? You know, you've got these tiny, tiny apartments. You've got cockroaches everywhere. I was there for 10 years. I'm not just talking out of my ass here. And, you know, you have rats everywhere and everything's very expensive. And it's a really tough, competitive city that is really, really cold in the winter and really hot in the summer and has about 6 weeks of the year where the temperature is actually really nice. And I think I just looked around at first and I just thought, what is the big deal? I just don't get it. Like even the tall buildings on the inside often, you know, when you go to the doctors or the dentist, kind of look very run down on the inside and a little bit scary. And then I kind of went on this journey over the first 5 years or so I was in New York where I just fell so in love with it. And it was because I was having a lot of anxiety at the time and just nonstop panic attacks. And I was very isolated from my friends and my family at the time. And I just realized that when you are in need, New York is the place that steps up. You know, like if you forget your credit card at the bodega, they will hand you the groceries and they'll say, you come back later. You know, you can come pay later. Like if you have a panic attack on the subway, and I have many panic attacks on the subway, New Yorkers are always there to like help you outside, make sure you're okay, get you to the hospital if you need, like to even just hold your hand. If ever you need help, New Yorkers are the very first to stop. Because I think in so many ways, like they're so used to things being so hectic that it doesn't faze them. Like nothing that you do will ever faze them. And I live in London now. And as much as I love London, there isn't that sense. And I think that's, for me, what made New York, for me, the best place in the world. That when you needed help, New Yorkers were always there in every way that you needed them.
Wow. That's great. That's not like the brand.
I know, right?
I mean, I'm not sure everybody would agree. Like, that's great. I've lived here my whole life. Well, not, you know, I've gone out for years at a time. But would I describe it as a place where if you need help, somebody would stop? I don't know. But that's great. I love it. We need some good PR. So
I think I might be comparing it to London. Like, London's a place where, like, you don't necessarily talk to cashiers. Like, you don't necessarily have conversations. You don't yell things out in the street. Like, I walk down the street in London and 10 people don't stop and talk to my dog in the way that they do in New York.
Okay, yes.
And I think feeling really connected to your city in that way was so meaningful for me, and that you could not go down the street without interacting with someone in some way. And London's very different in that way. And it's something that, you know, I'm pretty new to London now and I miss New York a lot in that way, how vibrant every block becomes when you're, you know, it's like a sea tide. I read this in the book, like it'll knock you over and it'll just push you back up. Yep. And you're just there like, okay.
Yes. Wow. I literally yesterday, I was picking up my kids from somewhere and this dog came over who I swear must have been like my grandmother in another life. I swear, this dog was like, we connected in such a way. And I'm not like a stop on the street, let's pet the dog type of person, even though I love my own dog in here somewhere. But I don't know. And I'm like, what is going on? I'm on the street for 5 minutes and I have a new pet. You know, now yes. I'm missing the dog. Where is, what was it called? Buttercup or something? I don't even know. Brandy, whiskey, something. Anyway. But yes, there is that element.
Some incredible dogs. It really, really does. And London, and this bothers me, all the dogs are very, almost like toy poodle-y.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, and that's a stereotype for London. And obviously it's not true everywhere. But certainly where I live in London, all the dogs are like little toy poodles. And my dog is this very anxious, very over the top, very dramatic rescue. And all of them are we've never seen anything like this before. Who are you? Where do you come from? And I'm like, he's a New Yorker. He spent the first 5 years of his life in New York. This is who he is. He's going to bark at you. And then he's going to try and sniff you. And then he's going to run away.
Oh, my gosh. Well, to shift gears, as they say, in workplaces I don't belong to. I read your article in Marie Claire about developmental coordination disorder. And that's like, what that's like for you, the sort of comorbidity with ADHD. And how that presents and what that has been like for you. So could you share a little bit more about that? Because it's obviously with the statistics you put in, it's quite common, more so than autism. And yet not that many people maybe know about it.
Yeah. So I think it presents as a clumsiness as its main symptom, but it presents in so many different ways that it's really hard to diagnose. You've got to rule out a lot of other different things first. You have to rule out, brain injuries. You have to rule out ADHD, autism, really everything in that kind of developmental zone. And it's almost a disorder of exclusion. Mm-hmm. And then you get to this thing and you're like, okay, this person has all these different symptoms and they're different from the next child with dyspraxia. And that's what they call it in the UK. In the US, it's called DCD, as you said. But this is what it is because it cannot be anything else. And for that reason, it's very, very hard to study. It's very hard to diagnose. And the US, for whatever reason, never quite got on board with it. Maybe it's the medical system because it's for profit, whereas, the NHS here isn't quite perfect either, but maybe that contributed. There are two moms actually in the UK who both of their kids had what's called dyspraxia here in the, I want to say the late 80s. And they were so frustrated because they just could not find any care for their kids. People knew what it was, but there was no support. There were no groups. There were no activities. There was just no support for them or for their children. And they actually started a foundation that has become this behemoth. It's called the Dyspraxia Foundation. And it now brings in, hundreds of thousands of profit every year. Well, not profit because it's a non-for-profit, but for the cause. And because of it, dyspraxia is actually very well known in the UK. And I always come back to the fact that it was just these two women who were so mad because their kids had this and no one was helping them. And it really became this country-changing movement in a way. And the US just never had it. I often think of those two mums who started this foundation, which is, as I said, a huge behemoth now. And I just think, if you guys hadn't done that, would anybody in the US? I don't think they did. Or if they did, it didn't catch on in the same way for various reasons.
Leave it to busy moms to just change up.
Yeah, right? Leave it to them to be like, oh, we're fixing this.
Yeah. So in the article, you talked about how day-to-day things like standing up after you've been sitting down or the coordination it takes to chew or eat are things that you have to actively think about throughout the course of your day.
Yeah.
How do you marry that with having a career based in words and, interacting with people in journalism and, the pace of life? And also, where do the panic attacks fit into all of this as well? So I don't, sorry, I'm totally delving into your personal.
No, it's all completely related. The panic attacks really came about in part because people with dyspraxia are much more likely to have sensory difficulties. And so I and other people with dyspraxia often get very overwhelmed by things. And I just have to figure out workarounds, figure out ways to treat it in myself. A lot of it is just saying I'm having a panic attack and I'm going to take 10 minutes and then I'll come back and being good with that, frankly. But for me and for a lot of people with dyspraxia, it really comes down to spiky skills. So you're very, very good at some things and you're very, very bad at others. And I've been lucky enough that in my career, the things that I am good at have compensated for the things that I am bad at. Mm-hmm. So because I do edit a lot and I can get through a lot of words and I can do a lot of different communications and a lot of different kinds of problem solving that do come really naturally to me. And I find not easy, but not in any way difficult either. Mm-hmm. I have been able to be allowed to focus on those things and not focus on the things that I am bad at, which are generally around organization, budgeting, particularly with journalism, you know, things like interviewing. I'm not very good at interviews, honestly. I'm trying to get better. I'm practicing, but
you're great
I'm
on this good. One. You mean interviewing other people or giving an interview?
No, giving an interview. I'm already interviewing other people, but actually speaking about things.
What, you're doing great. This is fabulous. I mean, it doesn't feel like an interview. This isn't like a traditional interview because I'm just like, you know, diving into
the... But I also want to impress you. I think you're amazing. And aww. I can feel myself tripping over myself and thinking, come on, you can do
better. Oh, stop. I think you're amazing. This is, you know, look at your book and your career and like, it's just really... awesome.
But, you know, something like we have amazing fashion team, for example. We are a fashion magazine. And because I can almost sit on my computer and write and edit and really kind of play point person in that way, mm-hmm. our other editors can go and be at the shows and mm-hmm. do all of these things, I think, for me would be very difficult from a sensory perspective. Mm-hmm. And I think you need someone like me who is just like, no, I don't want to go to fashion shows. That sounds great for you. We should definitely do it. But I'm going to sit there and I'm going to like, organize it from behind the scenes. And I think I've been very lucky in that all my jobs, because of the things that, as I say, I like think I am good at, I've been given the leeway and the understanding to not be thrown into situations that are hard for me.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
This message is sponsored by Greenlight. As kids get older, some things about parenting can get easier. I mean, not many, but some. But others don't, like having conversations about money. Point is, kids won't really know how to manage their money unless they're actually in charge of it, and that is where Greenlight can help. Greenlight is a debit card and money app made for families. Parents can send money to their kids and keep an eye on their kids' spending and saving, while kids and teens build money confidence and lifelong financial literacy skills. With the Greenlight app, kids can learn how to save, invest, and spend wisely, thanks to games that teach money skills in a fun and accessible way. I got Greenlight debit cards for my kids. The greatest thing, you can actually add their photos that take up half the card. So when I handed the cards to the kids, they were like, this is so exciting. So they look great. Unfortunately, I only put the required 2 cents on at the beginning to make sure they worked. So the kids were like, well, what should I spend my 2 cents on? Anyway, millions of parents and kids are learning about money on Greenlight. It's the easy, convenient way for parents to raise financially smart kids and families to navigate life together. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free when you go to greenlight.com/Zibby. That's greenlight.com/Zibby to try Greenlight for free. Greenlight.com/Zibby.
That's great. Yesterday in my office, I have like impaired spatial relations. Like I cannot fit things together. I am really bad at that. Like I once got tested and this person was like, so you must get into like a lot of car accidents. And I was like, I do get into a lot of car accidents. Like, so yesterday in my office, there were like 2 existing computer plugs and they were different shaped, like little box thingies that the plug goes into. And I was trying to fit a third one in and move them around. I was like, I literally can't figure this out. I can't figure out how to put 3 chargers here, but I can like run this business and do everything else. But like yes. This step, forget it. I need help. So I guess finding your...
And it's so embarrassing too, because when you feel yourself to be someone who like really does take on leadership roles in your life and obviously with your family, it's embarrassing to have to say, I can't do this incredibly basic thing. I mean, I can't drive at all.
Okay.
I would cause accidents. You know, I've been told I probably could if I had a disability-specific car and an instructor, but I've never quite looked into that because I'm in London now, and why would I? She was great. But certainly it feels very stupid to be able to do a lot of different things than to say, no, I can't drive there. Someone's going to have to drive me there. It's very infantilizing in a way. And it's something I've really had to come to terms with and being like, nope, can't do that. Sorry, someone else is going to have to, you know, fix this very basic thing that I just can't do.
Yeah. Well, I totally get it. What does it mean now to be your digital director of Marie Claire, right? What does that mean? And how do you keep magazines relevant when, like, the whole world is like, the death knell is ringing for magazines, which, by the way, I love magazines, but you know, like, how do you reinvent? And obviously you're in charge of the digital, which is the most important.
Yeah.
So tell me about that and how you.
I think obviously in the last 20 years, we've seen huge shifts in digital media in general. Like we've seen digital media create huge shifts in media. Mm-hmm. And we've seen just an enormous amount of change. It's really made the entire media industry a completely new industry. And I think in the last few years, I've definitely had workplaces that were like, all right, we're going to chase the traffic, or we're going to chase the commerce, or we're going to chase this or that. And it never quite works when you chase one thing. When you kind of throw everything else out the window and try and chase one thing, it never is sustainable in the long term. And one thing that I try really hard to do at Marie Claire, and that I work with a team that does feel the same, is we try and do not just everything well, which is also true, but we try and focus on the reader, and we try and like focus less so on everything else, all these little parts that you really can obsess over, and more focus on like, okay, how are we reaching this reader? Is it through search? If so, what are we doing to make that the best experience possible? Mm-hmm. Is it through newsletter? If so, what are we doing to make it to make sure we know who that reader is, that we're reaching them, mm-hmm. and that when they see our newsletter, they're opening it and they care about what we have to say. Mm-hmm. If it's Facebook, what platforms are they on? How are we reaching them? Like, what strategies are we using to make sure that we get to them? And I do think that when you bring it back to that, it's not a recipe for success, because media is turbulent by nature, but it is much more sustainable as a strategy than anything that's like, you know what, we're going to pivot to video and we're going to make loads of money from video and everything's going to be fine. I think those kind of singular strategies, which we did for a lot of very panicked years in the 2010s in media, don't tend to work.
That's great advice. We're like currently thinking about like our own. Well, anyway, it's just very good advice, because we're also like trying to reach the readers. Like, that's what everything is about, right? Like, this podcast and everything is just like, you know, celebrating reading, and like, how do you reach people who are already celebrating reading?
Yeah, I certainly with newsletter, that's been my kind of big learning from the last year and a half. And it does feel very like mid-2000s. And you're like, oh, a newsletter. Like, yeah, I too had those in the mid-2000s. We found that like with social and search platforms constantly changing, it is the one way we can reach our reader directly, our loyal readers, where they are. And we have really invested in that in the last year. And we've seen a lot of sustained success from it too. So that's like, this year I'm thinking a lot about newsletter. Last year I was thinking about something different, but this year I'm thinking that is a fantastic way to reach the person that you want to reach, rather than like a big broad audience. You know, it's all kind of about that one person anyway, right?
Yeah, totally. Good advice. Okay. Turns out I'm getting career advice from you when I'm supposed to be interviewing you about your novel, which, okay, back to the novel.
As discussed, I'm not very good at interviews, so I really do go on tangents sometimes.
I love it. Have to be smart. No, I love it. This is how you get to know people, right? This is like, you know, what's on our minds and all of that. Wait, you referenced earlier that you were working on another book that wasn't quite as pressing.
Yeah.
Oh, so tell me about that book.
Ugh, I'm loving working on it. Everyone Who Could Forgive Me Is Dead was my first book. And it was a huge learning curve, because I'd never written fiction. I began during the pandemic. As it turns out, writing fiction is not something you can just like do, write a draft of, send it in and be like, great, let's do it. Like, I went through 8 different drafts and each draft was a full rewrite. And I just got very lucky that I had people on my team who really believed in the book and were willing to get me to this finish line. But the second book is coming a lot easier, because after these 8 drafts, I have a slightly better sense of what I'm doing and how to pace and how to, you know, just how to go about it. And it's also not really about me or my life. And I'm really enjoying that too. But sorry, you asked what it was about. It's about 2 sisters. One of them is really, really famous. She's a singer, and she and her sister are estranged. They have very different lives. One has a very low-key life in London. One is a megastar in New York City. And then the man that led them being estranged, not perhaps in the way that you'd expect, shows up dead. And very quickly, a lot of the evidence points to both sisters, and they have to really figure out how far they're going to go to protect themselves and also protect each other after years and years of being apart.
So where is the fascination with the dead people coming from?
Oh, gosh. It's funny, actually, because my mother always says that when she took me to the library when I was a kid, all I wanted to do was find books about people who were dying or dead or about to die but didn't know it. The sick, the dead, and the dying, she called it. And she was quite freaked out by it. I don't think she was like, where is this going? This child is like 7 years old. I don't know. I think I've always been uniquely interested in trauma and the ways that we process it and move on from it, not particularly from a personal level. I think I just find it interesting, for better and for worse, probably.
And when you said that everyone who can forgive me is dead is much more personal, what elements of it?
Not the title, but...
Well, that's up for debate still. I'm not convinced. Not convinced at all. Especially the more I hear.
Yeah.
but what pieces of this are sort of direct lifts?
Charlie is very much, particularly when Charlie first moves to New York City, mm-hmm. and Charlie's very naive, and Charlie really is kind of just vibing her way through the day. Mm-hmm. That is very much where I was at 22 when I moved to New York and didn't have a clue what I was doing. And then obviously later in the book, Charlie has a lot of anxiety and panic related to her trauma. Mm-hmm. And that was different for me. But I went through a phase in my mid-20s where I was really having just terrible, terrible anxiety. And it was taking over my whole life. And there are a lot of panic attacks in the book and a lot of just like rising panic about, in Charlie's case, something very valid. Mm-hmm. And I think in my case, it was just, you know, the anxiety in my head convincing me it was valid. Mm-hmm. But it all feels the same, right? So all of that was very much based on my personal experiences.
And how do you feel you're managing your anxiety now?
Better than I was in my mid-20s. But I mean, I always just kind of think therapy and medication, if needed, are not cure-all. But I believe in therapy so much. And I truly, truly believe that therapy saved me over and over again throughout my life.
Amazing. What advice do you have for aspiring authors?
I would always say don't do what I did. I literally just like wrote up a novel and I was like, you know what? Right, like all these communities online seem really scary. Like the chances of getting published seem really scary. I'm just going to start sending it off. And that's not what you should do. You should have patient readers. You should have a plan. You should have an idea of your genre. You should have competitive titles. You should have a very strong sense of how it's going to sit on shelves. You should try and sell it better to the people who are going to try and sell it. I generally think that as much as when you start fiction, there's this terrifying knowledge that the chances of getting published are very, very small and it really can put you off. But at the same time, doing a manageable amount of research into the industry is a good idea. And I've always been someone who throws herself in feet first. I wouldn't have done that. But I also would have tried to make sure I didn't psych myself out too much, because you can do that too. Publisher's Marketplace as a tool was mm-hmm. really, really helpful, just because I wanted to find a agent. And that was obviously the starting place. And I found an amazing agent, Claire Friedman at Inkwell, who is just an incredible partner in everything that we do. And who also bed with me through 8 different drafts and said, we're going to get there. We're going to get there, even though, you know, we're not quite there yet. But to do that, Publisher's Marketplace was my best friend, because I really had to figure out who that person was. And once you have that person in your corner, once you have that teammate and you trust them and you're willing to, sorry, I'm not crying over this. I was slightly sore. I'm not going to stop crying.
You're not going to cry over Publisher's Marketplace.
I think that's amazing, but I'm not sobbing over a video call about it. Once you have that, things get easier because you have a partner and everything. And until then, Publisher's Marketplace and beta readers, I think, are your best friend.
I love that. Jenny, thank you so much. Thanks for coming on Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books.
It was such a pleasure. I'm such a big fan. And thank you so much for reading. I so appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. Don't forget to follow me on Instagram at Zibby Owens and at Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. Also sign up for my newsletter at ZibbyOwens.com and sign up for my virtual book club and meet lots of authors on Zoom every other week. Thanks so much to Steve and Ryan at Texture Sound for the sound editing. And thank you to Morning Moon Productions for providing this fantastic intro and outro music.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.